Thanks for joining us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, and we are talking the world of wildlife on the show today with our guest, David Drake. David's an Extension Wildlife Specialist and professor, and we're going to start by talking about wildlife crossings. Love to have you join the conversation. You can give us a call with your wildlife question at 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. David Drake, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Well, thank you, Larry. And I'm flying solo today. Jamie is off with the family event. So, Jamie, hello if you're listening.
Well, we'll get her back at some point down the road
That's right.
You know, just on a kind of a serious note here, millions of animals get killed on roads every year. It's dangerous for them, and of course, it's dangerous for us. What are some things that are being done to lessen road mortality?
Yeah, you know, obviously, we are an urbanized country. And with that urbanization comes a lot of impervious surface in the form of roads. And roads can take many different forms, from, you know, just a simple two-lane road running through your residential community at 15 miles an hour to multi-lane highways that are 70, 75 mile an hour speed limits. And, you know, the greater the lanes, the more lanes you have in a road and the higher the speed limit, the more that road becomes a barrier. So if animals are trying to get from one side of the road to the next, again, the more lanes you have, the higher that speed limit, the less chance they've got to successfully navigate across that road. And so, as you mentioned, millions and millions of species get killed each year. It's estimated that as many as 200 individual human beings get killed from colliding with wildlife each year. Upwards of 26,000 people get injured every year colliding with wildlife. And it's estimated that over $10 billion worth of damage is done in terms of vehicular damage from colliding with wildlife. So, you know, $10 billion with a B as in Bravo. I mean, that's a small country's GDP right there. So that's how much money is being wasted. So it is a real problem. It's a persistent problem, unfortunately, and it has it does have serious impacts to wildlife populations and sustainability and things like that, in addition to human health. So yeah, there's many things that are being done, from obviously putting up road crossing signs warning people that this is a popular space where deer in particular cross roads. Sometimes you'll see turtle crossing signs, things like that. Other places are digging tunnels and putting culverts underneath roads so that small mammals, reptiles, amphibians like snakes, frogs, salamanders can cross under that. And then you've got these very large, complex attempts to mitigate road crossing damage. If you go up to Banff National Park in Canada, for example, they've got road crossing structures that go across the Trans-Canada Highway. And outside of Los Angeles now, they're building the largest road crossing structure that will ever that will currently be when it comes into effect. They'll be the largest road crossing structure in the world, and it's crossing 10 lanes of traffic. So essentially, it's crossing Highway 101, if people are familiar with that roadway, that highway system in the Los Angeles area. But that that road crossing structure is going to connect Santa Monica Hills to the Simi Hills, or Santa Monica Mountains to the Simi Hills. And what prompted that is P-22, this very famous mountain lion, got hit and killed by a vehicle trying to cross that roadway. And it kind of started to manifest into a fundraising effort. But it's going to cost $100 million to build this road crossing structure.
Yeah, public-private, I guess.
Public-private, yep. And it's if you go up to, like, for example, the ones in Banff or other places around the country, essentially it's a bridge that goes across the highway or the road, and it's a natural bridge. So once they get the infrastructure built with the concrete, then they put down soil and vegetation, and you know, up in Banff, it looks like you're in a forest, for example. And when you're on top of that thing, which I've had the privilege of being on top of it, you forget you're on top of a highway. It's pretty impressive. And so the idea is that they would then put fences up along the roadways, and that fence would funnel the wildlife to that bridge crossing structure. So they would cross, over that bridge versus trying to cross across the lanes where the traffic is actually actively going.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
It is.
And we, you know, here in Wisconsin, I read somewhere where if you did the math, it would be the equivalent of a deer getting hit by a car every 45 minutes in the state of Wisconsin.
Yep.
But we really can't put those over the road structures here, I think the DNR says there's just too many places where the deer go across.
That's it. And I think, you know, obviously what occurs when, especially if you're going to invest $100 million, for example, as the California DOT is doing, if you're going to do something like that, an intense amount of study goes into this to understand where those pinch points are and where the most common road crossings are from a wildlife standpoint. And so there's a lot of research and study that goes into it so that you have a strategic place that you're actually building these structures either under the roads or over the roads so that it can be as effective as possible.
And I think in respect to the DNR, they have done a fair amount of work with the smaller species.
Yeah, they have, for sure. And you know, again, it's something as simple as putting up road crossing signs warning people that this is where frogs or turtles cross. But putting a culvert under the road is much easier than building a $100 million structure over the road. And then every time we talk about this, it always brings me back to this great call-in show. I don't know, maybe you heard this, Larry, but it was down in the southern states someplace. And these two radio disc jockeys were talking about the road crossing signs for deer. And this woman calls in and she goes, "Well, why don't the deer cross where those signs are? Don't they know they're supposed to?" And she was very serious about that. So,
oh my goodness me.
We just needed a little bit more training of the wildlife.
Tom in Green Bay will give you a chance. Hi, Tom.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. My question is two questions. One, my grandson, and they got home, and there was a big snapping turtle in the middle of the backyard laying eggs. Took her about 3 hours, and I can't believe a 12-year-old sat and watched her for 3 hours. My son put what I think is a pretty flimsy cage over the site to try to keep raccoons out. What kind of cage or structure should he be putting around this to try to protect it? And secondly, how long do those eggs incubate? My grandkids would love to see the little ones when they start hatching.
Yeah.
Yeah, Tom, great questions, and kudos to you, to your son or grandson who watched it for 3 hours and wasn't attached to their phone or computer. So that's awesome. That's a great way to spend 3 hours, in my opinion. It sounds like your son did the right thing of putting a cage around. That's one of the recommendations, especially if you can identify the location of an active turtle nest, is to build a cage out of either 1-inch by 2-inch or 1-inch by 3-inch wire mesh. And essentially, you would want to build a cage that's roughly about a foot in diameter or so around that nest. Ideally, bury the bottom of that cage about 4 inches into the soil, and then put a top on that cage. And if you can, also stake it down so that if a raccoon does come along, that if it is going to get to that nest, it actually has to work to do so, and it's not an easy meal for it. So it sounds like what your son did is correct. And it depends on the species, but typically it's 2 to 4 months of incubation time. So if I recall, for snapping turtles, I think it's about a 3-month incubation period. Larry's going to have a turtle biologist on at 12:30 today, and he probably will have, or she will probably have, a little bit more specific information. But I think it's about 3 months incubation period for snapping turtles. So maybe by the end of the summer, start paying attention to that.
Tom, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Let's take a call from Don in Iron River. Hi, Don.
Hey, I got a squirrel who's got a body gray phase and the black tail. How weird is that?
It's only weird if you make it weird. So gray squirrels are is common for us to see them with different color phases. So obviously, gray squirrels, the most common coat color is gray. But it's not uncommon to see blonde gray squirrels, all black gray squirrels. Sometimes you'll see piebald or albino gray squirrels. Sometimes, you know, white-faced gray squirrels. And so what typically happens is that gene will get into the breeding pool, and it'll just continue to propagate, especially in localized areas. So what it sounds like is that squirrel you're seeing is primarily a gray squirrel, but there must be some black phase in the breeding pool that's in that local area. And instead of being all gray or all black, that squirrel is a combination of both gray and black.
Yeah, very interesting. Don, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Speaking of color phase, I saw something on the news about an albino skunk.
Oh, interesting.
That had been released or, given up. It was a wild animal. It reminded me about DNR's effort to keep wildlife wild.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, and obviously that effort, we've talked about that a number of times in this program, but the idea is, you know, just because you find, especially a young animal, that it doesn't mean it's been abandoned. If it's by itself, it doesn't mean it's been abandoned by its mom or its parents, and to actually just leave it be, unless you can determine for certain that that animal is injured or needs some kind of human intervention. But generally, let the animal be and let the mom or the parents take care of that animal as they normally would.
Yeah, and in an urban setting.
Yeah, that's interesting.
You think about rabbits in an urban setting. Yeah. I've had many times where there's, in my lawn, I've had baby rabbits.
Yeah. Yep.
In the lawn. And the mom, I'm sure, is around somewhere.
Yeah, yep. So a lot of times the rabbit will either, if you have kind of organic or loamy soil, the rabbit will just kind of dig out a little depression in the ground, or they'll use an existing depression in the ground, and then she'll have her young and deposit them in that depression and then cover them up with grass and other kind of organic material as she goes out, and she'll feed for the day, and then she'll come back and nurse them at the nighttime. But that's the evolution and the kind of the ecology of how rabbits raise their young is they let them be for a good part of the day, and then they'll come back and check on them, but they conceal them, and generally, you know, it works out pretty well.
Lynn in La Crosse has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Lynn.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. The robins around our house, which we always have nesting, are doing an unusual thing this year in that they're hitting the windows with unusual frequency.
Okay.
And so I'm just wondering if you have any ideas about why they might be doing that this year.
Yeah. Who knows why they're doing it this year? It's likely that you have a different set of robins in your area this year than you had in previous years. And so you just may get a different individual with a bit of a different personality. But typically the reason they hit the windows, a couple of reasons, but one is, especially around nesting season like it is right now, is that the male robins, and sometimes it's hard to differentiate the male from the female, but the males have almost an all-black head, where the females will have more of a grayish head. But typically the males are the ones who are defending the territory that the female is nesting in. And if they see the reflection in the window, they take that reflection as a competitor trying to intrude on their territory. And so they'll go then, in their mind, defend the territory or defend against the intruder, and not realizing that they're actually seeing their reflection in the window, their own reflection in the window. So that is probably the most likely cause or reason why this is occurring. Birds will also hit windows as they fly, because the window, either they don't see it there or it looks like a pass-through for them or whatever the case is. Regardless of why they're hitting the window, the best thing to do is, if you have shades or blinds, is to drop your shades and blinds near the day so you can cut that reflection off or break that reflection up. If you can't do that, hang something in your window, and it could be something as simple as an old compact disc little recording device that you might hang on string. It could be strips of aluminum foil, or you can go online or go to a nature store, and you can actually get decals that you can put on your window, and that will break up the reflective surface so that the bird doesn't see itself as easily. And then once you break up that reflective surface, that hitting of the window should cease.
Good luck, Lynn. Thank you so much for calling. You can join in, too, talking the world of wildlife today with David Drake, Extension Wildlife Specialist and professor in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for joining in to WPR News. Larry Mueller here with my guest, David Drake. We're talking the world of wildlife with him today. Questions, maybe an experience to share, the number to call, 800-642-1234. You can email to talk@WPR.org. David, there was a recently released study conducted looking at CWD and possible spread to humans. What did they find out?
Yeah, this is a really interesting study. CWD, or chronic wasting disease, is this unfortunately insidious disease that occurs when a brain protein kind of goes a little wacky. And so they're called, these brain proteins are called prions or prions. And it typically affects both captive and free-ranging deer and elk, things like that. And essentially, it's a fatal disease. So once the animal's exposed to CWD, it kills the animal eventually. And it is a really nasty disease because it causes a lot of emaciation. It causes the animal to not be aware of what's going on because his brain is starting to be attacked by these prions and things like that. And obviously, with in Wisconsin and other states, the hunting or harvesting of deer is a really big deal. And a lot of people are concerned, obviously, because CWD has been spreading throughout Wisconsin and other states, especially as the state agencies start looking for it. So there's a lot of concern about if I shoot a deer, does it have CWD? Would it test positive for CWD? And if it does, can I eat that meat? And generally, the recommendation is that if you harvest a deer, that you be very careful when you, especially if you're processing the deer yourself, that you're very careful that you don't cut into the spine, for example, and some of the adenoids and some other tissue areas of the deer. And so people are very, very reluctant typically to eat deer, especially if it's been exposed to CWD. So these researchers, the lead researchers from the National Institute of Health, and essentially what they did is they took two different types of prions that eventually will develop CWD, and they exposed brain cell cultures to these prions for 7 straight days and then monitored it for 180 days. And they were able to determine after 180 days that there was no CWD that developed in human brain cultures. And so their findings are that that there's a pretty good species barrier, that CWD is unlikely to mm-hmm. infect human beings, even if they were to eat CWD positive meat. And the caveat is that for the general population, that they think that people are safe from eating CWD positive meat. There might be some odd or rare genetic dispositions of certain people that might increase their exposure, but there's still no guarantee that even if they were to eat meat that's CWD positive, that they would then get CWD. And typically CWD shows up in human beings as Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, not necessarily CWD. But this is a first of its kind of study, and so I'm sure other studies are going to be replicating this to verify that result. But it's an encouraging result.
Just in terms of Wisconsin, I'm trying to remember how many counties in Wisconsin now have deer infected. Yeah. It's quite a large number.
It's quite a few. And maybe we can look this up on a break, but I'm going to guess it's probably a majority of the counties now. That, obviously it started in southern Wisconsin. I think 2002 was the first first positive, but it has spread throughout the entire state, all regions of the state right now. And so we'll look up on a break how many counties it is, but I think it's a majority of the counties by now.
Let's go to Blake in Osceola next, who has a question. Hi, Blake.
Hi. Last week I was on the St. Croix River fishing, just drifting downstream in my boat, and I saw this small animal swimming across the river to an island, and I thought it was a muskrat. It looked like it was dragging something behind it, like a stick or something, and I watched it, and it got to shore on the island. It crawled out, and it was a squirrel, and it was just a bushy tail that was dragging behind. I didn't know squirrels could swim. He swam so perfectly straight despite the current being so fast. Why would he be swimming out to an island? And I didn't know. How often do they swim?
Yeah, well, I'm not sure how often they swim, and you're right that squirrels are not one of those mammal species that's going to come first to your mind that is an aquatic species for sure. But there's quite a few species that can swim if they need to or if given the opportunity. And I'm not sure how many squirrels are out there doing the backstroke in the water, but clearly this one was. And why it's moving to the island, I have no certain answer to give to you, but I've got a couple of suggestions. And one would be, obviously on the island, there's probably few, if any, predators. So it, likely it's safe out there. And there's probably some good resources out there, especially if it's an island and other animals can't get to it. There's probably some pretty good food resources that maybe this squirrel doesn't have to compete with other squirrels and other animals for. Maybe good nesting sites in the trees if it was a forested island and things like that. But clearly, there was something out there that motivated that squirrel to swim across the river.
You know, it reminds me of a story that a guy told me about squirrels and muskies and muskie fishing. The guy said he was muskie fishing, and there was an acorn on a limb that was hanging just about to the water, and the squirrel was trying to get out to there and got out to almost there and got the acorn, and this muskie came up and grabbed the squirrel. And he said, well, what was really surprising was when that muskie came back up and replaced the acorn on the end.
Oh, that's awesome.
He had me going for quite a while there.
That's great.
I shortened the story up there.
That's beautiful.
Oh, man. You can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234. You can email us to talk@wpr.org. Lee Rayburn, our technical director today, sent us something from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, May 26th of 2023, from April of 22 to March of 23, the DNR reported 17,187 CWD test results, including 1,492 positives. The testing year included the first detections in wild deer in buffalo, langlade, Waupaca, and Winnebago. And in addition, the disease was found at deer farms in Dodge and Lincoln counties. As of this spring, and now that's from 2023, 60 of the state's 72 counties have had CWD detected in them or are considered CWD affected. So that was March of 23, and I'm betting that's
more than 60 by now.
It's probably more than 60.
Yeah, I think, unfortunately, CWD is never going to go away. And it's just a matter of how best do we figure out how to live with it and how best do we help the deer herd sustain.
Yeah, it's a terrible, terrible thing. Well, the Wisconsin DNR is celebrating the 30th year of endangered species license plates. How are they celebrating? Do you know?
Yeah, so they are going to provide a $25 rebate to anybody who buys a endangered species license plate between now and the end of this year. And so it's, I think, $40 for the license plate, $15 of it goes to the Wisconsin DOT, and $25 goes to the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources Endangered Resource Fund. And this has been a real boon for people who are buying these plates. It's a nice fundraiser for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. You know, obviously, when you go to buy a hunting license or a trapping or fishing license, that money goes into the game side of the Bureau. Game being any animal that can be harvested. But there's not always necessarily a dedicated fund or license that supports non-game species, and especially endangered resources. And so this license plate is one way to kind of generate some revenue that helps endangered species. And that money then goes to support habitat acquisition. It goes to support habitat management. So all the DNR biologists are out there managing habitat to support endangered species, as well as supporting the specific species that might be endangered, plant or animal. And although it's dedicated strictly to endangered species, obviously as they manage habitat for endangered species, non-endangered species, both directly and indirectly, also benefit from that habitat management acquisition support and things like that. So, yeah, it's great that it's been going on for, 30 years, I think it says. Continue. Hopefully it goes on in perpetuity, and go out and buy a license plate. And also, if you want to change your license plate, because the endangered species license plates, they have different symbols on them. And so if you'd like to change your license plate, you also can get a $25 rebate for changing endangered species plates.
That is very, very cool.
Yeah.
You can join in, too, by the way. Open lines get you on pretty quickly here. If you got an experience you want to share about wildlife I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Wondering about, you know, we've been, the last several years, we've been hearing a lot about bats and problems with bats. What's the status of our bats here in Wisconsin?
Yeah, so the bat population, again, is similar to chronic wasting disease and that disease. The bat population in Wisconsin is experiencing white-nose syndrome, which is another type of disease. CWD is a protein or a prion-based disease. White-nose syndrome is a fungal disease, so it's a non-native fungus that gets into the hibernaculum, or those areas that bats hibernate during the wintertime. And so we've got 8 species of bats in the state of Wisconsin. 4 of our species we consider migratory, so they, as the temperature starts cooling off and their food source, which is primarily insects, starts to dissipate, they fly south so that they can stay in the warmer weather, and that food source is constant throughout the winter months. Then we've got 4 species that are state resident species, and those 4 species, because they stay here year-round, in the wintertime, that food source of insects is not available, so their strategy to survive through the winter is to hibernate. And when they do that, they typically go into cave and mine systems. And in those cave and mine systems are roughly about 50 degrees Fahrenheit or so in high humidity. And unfortunately, that is also ideal growing temperature, growing medium for this fungus that is creates white nose syndrome. And so when bats go into hibernate, if they're in these hibernaculum that has this fungus, the fungus gets on the bats. And essentially, it will cause the bats sometimes to wake up from hibernation during the wintertime. And so bats are true hibernators. So when they go into this what we call a state of torpor, where they reduce their metabolism, their heart rate, respiration rate, and go into a deep sleep for months at a time, when they get woken from that prematurely, it causes them a tremendous amount of energy to wake back up. And so they start burning resources that they're reliant on to survive through the hibernation stage. The other issue is when they wake up through CWD, that they're very disoriented, and a lot of times they'll leave that hibernation site and they'll go out into the outside world where it's cold and it's not very favorable, the weather conditions. So they'll die of hypothermia. And in addition, the fungal disease, they call it white nose syndrome because it looks like the bat has been dipped, their nose has been dipped in powdered sugar. But this fungus will also get on their wing membranes, and it will eat holes in the wing membrane. And obviously, these bats are flying mammals, true flying mammals. And so if they've got holes in their wings, they can't fly. And if they can't fly, they also can't catch these flying insects that they rely upon for food. So that's the state of it. I know people are working very hard to try to find some kind of a vaccine or a cure for white nose syndrome. And so far, nothing viable has been found. There's some promising avenues, but nothing that is being able to be applied across the landscape widespread to stop this disease. So they are also finding that some bats are actually perhaps building a natural immunity, so that they are being exposed to white nose syndrome during their hibernation period, and they're surviving that, and they're able to come out in the spring and be active without too much detrimental health effect. And so those bats are starting to build some immunity, and hopefully that will be passed on as they reproduce. But bats are also slow reproducers, and it will take a while for that immunity to spread through the population.
By slow producers, what do you mean, reproducers?
Once every year, once every 2 years, and they only have 1 to 3 young at a time. So it's not like a rabbit, for example, that we're talking about, where they're just pumping them out.
Yeah. Carol in Whitewater, what's on your mind?
Hi, I have a friend. I board my horse at her place, and she has some barns and other buildings. They're aluminum sided, but she said that I can put bat houses up. And I'm wondering, first, where you recommend I purchase them, and then how I should position them, like which direction and how high.
Yeah, all great questions, and thank you so much for doing that, because anything like that is a boost to the bat population. And again, as we just talked about, especially our state resident bat species, they really need some help right now. So I appreciate you doing that very much. The best thing to do is you can build bat houses yourself if you want to. You can buy them in a variety of stores. But the best thing to do is go to Bat Conservation International, and I think it's batcon.org is the website address. But it's Bat Conservation International. And Bat Conservation International is a research and advocacy group based out of Austin, Texas. But there's a wonderful resource for clearinghouse of information for bats. And if you go to their website, they've got a great resource page about bat houses in terms of what you should look for if you're buying a bat house, or how you should construct bat houses, where you should put them up, and things like that. But essentially, for bat houses, if you want to put it against a building, as it sounds like you're going to do, multi-chamber bat houses are not as important as if you're going to put a bat house on a pole or on a tree. But especially if you're going to put a bat house on a pole, multi-chamber bat houses are pretty essential, simply because more bats can get in there and there's more thermal protection with those multiple chambers. But if you're going to put it on a building and anywhere, it should be generally south-facing, simply because you get the most thermal exposure when it's south-facing. And put it as high up off the ground as you possibly can, but it's recommended that you try to get it at least 10 to 15 feet off the ground if you can. If you're putting it on a tree, you don't want to put it just underneath an overhanging limb, because that limb provides an avenue for a lot of predators to be able to get to the bat house and actually predate or perhaps kill those bats that are in the house. But generally, south-facing, up as high as off the ground as you can get. And go to Bat Conservation International. They've got a lot of other wonderful tips and resources that will help you understand how helpful bat houses are, where to put them, what to buy, how to build them, all sorts of things like that.
Yeah, Carol, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Another question relating to bats, and yeah, this is one we often get. I've got some bats that are up in my attic, somebody might say, yeah, and what do I do about that?
Yep. Yeah, so typically bats that are in buildings are generally, most often, either the big brown bat or the little brown bat, which are two of our state resident species. And ideally, we don't want bats and humans to mix any more than is necessary. It's not good for the bats all of the time, and bats are also can carry rabies. Theoretically, any mammal species can carry rabies, but bats and striped skunks are two of our more common carriers of rabies in the wildlife world. And when I say that, it's not as if every bat's got rabies. I think the last time it was tested, the last statistic I saw, I think 1 to maybe 2% of all bats that were tested had rabies. So it's the vast majority of bats are healthy and don't have rabies. So I don't want to stoke a worry there, yeah, or a concern there. But if they're in your attic, the best thing to do is to make sure they cannot get into your living quarters or into your living space. And especially in older buildings or older houses that have settled, and you've got a lot of cracks that might be in the foundation, or you've got some cracks where the side of the house and the eaves are, you know, those create little spaces, and bats only need about 5/8 of an inch, depending on the species, to
size
get in.
Size of a dime.
Size of a dime. You know, look for any venting, vent pipes that are coming through your roof. And make sure those vent pipes, that the animals, and not just bats, but it could be squirrels, mice, mm-hmm, rats, you know, all sorts of things. Make sure they can't get into that vent pipe and use that as an access point into your house. But the most important thing is, if in these older houses, if you've got bats in your attic, just make sure they cannot get into the living quarters. And if you're comfortable with them living in the attic, continue to have them be there. If you're not comfortable with them living in the attic, you can either do this yourself, or there are resources, or there are businesses out there that will help you remove bats from your attic. But typically a one-way excluding door that would be put up where you would seal all access points except for maybe a couple. You'd put the one-way excluding door up for maybe a week or so. When the bats go out at night to feed, they go out that door. They can go out, push out, but they can't get back in. Leave that one-way excluding door up for maybe a week or so. Once you're certain all the bats are out, remove those one-way excluding doors and then seal up those remaining access points. The caveat with all of this is, because bats may be in your attic right now with pups and feeding pups, and because they are the pups require nursing from the mom, that you cannot use those excluding doors during much of the summer. So I think it's, if I recall correctly, I think it's from May 30th to August 15th or something like that. Make sure you do not exclude bats during the summer months, because if you exclude the mom and she can't get back in to feed or nurse the kits, then you've essentially also killed the kits.
Yeah. David Drake, our guest today, taking a look at the world of wildlife, and you can join in. Open lines get you on pretty quickly at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or email. The email address, talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today on this Wildlife Day with our guest, David Drake, Extension Wildlife Specialist, professor in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. Questions for him? Hope you'll join in. The number to call is 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. David, you've had a number of research projects going, I know, with a lot of urban canid projects. Yep. And others. Talk a little about your research.
Yeah, so most of what I do is focused on urban ecology, so urban wildlife ecology, and trying to understand how both people and wildlife share cities or urban areas. And, I think it's a pretty relevant topic for a number of reasons. Partly because 85% of the United States is currently considered an urban population. So, 85% of us live in urban areas. About 50% of the world's urbanized. By 2050, about 70% of the world's going to be urbanized. So we're moving in that direction. And even though the vast majority of us are urbanized, the footprint of urbanization is relatively small. It's about 5 to 10% of the total land mass of the United States, the lower contiguous 48 states. But the impact is pretty severe. Obviously, when you urbanize an area, there's a lot of fragmentation. There's a lot of change of that landscape, a lot of impervious surface, a lot of built buildings, massive concentrations of human beings and everything that comes with them in terms of noise, pollution, light effect, light pollution, all sorts of things like that. And so one of the projects that we've had going on for the last 10 years, we've been live trapping and radio calling red foxes and coyotes in the city of Madison. And it's been a really fun project on all sorts of different levels. But it's been fun because the public is, especially with coyotes, the public is intensely interested in these animals. And I think they're surprised sometimes when they see these animals in the city that they actually can live in the city. But both of these species are extremely adept at living in urban areas and sharing the same landscape that we do. So that's been really fun. The public has been very supportive of our project. A lot of times we invite the public to come out and trap with us. And I can talk a little bit more about that in a minute. We rely on the public to report sightings to us. And so if you see a coyote or a red fox in Madison or any of the suburbs, please go to our, if you just Google iNaturalist and UW Urban Canid Project, our iNaturalist page will pop up and you can report the sighting there. And that reporting of sightings is extremely important to us because it helps us identify where perhaps coyotes or fox are that we may not be aware of. It also helps us identify how often these animals are being seen, so we can kind of monitor populations and things like that. But one thing that we found and it's been really fun to observe is that typically coyotes and red fox do not get along out in non-urban areas. So coyotes are about roughly 2 to 3 times the size of a red fox, and because they're larger, they're the more dominant of the two species. And in non-urban areas, coyotes will typically kill red fox to limit competition for a limited resource, be it food or den sites or space or whatever the case might be. But we've been able to demonstrate here in Madison, at least, and we suspect that this is probably true for other urban areas. We just don't have data to support this. But we've been able to demonstrate in Madison that coyotes and red fox actually get along. They can peacefully coexist in this urban area. And we've documented and demonstrated that these animals are in the same space at the same time. Both coyotes and red fox are, within feet of each other. And so that's been really interesting. And what we think is happening is because there's just an abundance of food on the landscape, that these animals can share that abundant resource and they don't have to compete for a limited resource. And so my current graduate student who's just about to finish up, she's been examining that question and looking at food resources and other resources that these animals will utilize in the urban area to see if that's actually what is the mechanism that's allowing that coexistence.
That's pretty cool. You're not doing anything with wild turkey, are you?
No, but I know there's a lot of interest in wild turkey, but no, I am not.
Oh, my goodness. The wild turkey populations in Wauwatosa, yeah. And it's amazing
it
to
is.
Me.
It is, I know.
And Madison.
Madison, yeah. If you go to the University of Wisconsin Arboretum, for example, I know the turkey population on the east side of Madison, they've got their own Facebook page. And so there is great interest, both positive and negative.
Oh, man. Brad and Wauwega, we'll go to you. Hi, Brad. What's on your mind?
Yes. Oh, okay. My aunt apologized. I have a question about the morel mushroom.
Sure.
I thought and I had heard, I don't know much about them, that they only go for 10 to 14 days. I had found my first batch this year on the 12th, and then in the same area of like a 60-yard span, then I found another batch on the 18th. And then again, a few, like 4 days later, and then another almost 2 week span, and my son found one last night. So I'm just curious about to me, the myth, if they only grow 10 to 14 days in an area.
I think it depends a bit on the weather.
Yeah, it does depend on the weather. I'm not sure about the specific time span, but it is a relatively short period of time in the spring, and typically the weather, and then you're also looking for dead elm trees. Which will also, the morels are typically associated with dead elm trees.
Yeah. Although they can come up wherever.
They can.
My dentist told me a great story some years back, Bill Thompson, that one of his clients said, I've got all these mushrooms in my backyard on the lawn. And he went over there and he said there was a bushel of morel mushrooms on her back lawn.
That's amazing. Yeah.
And she didn't want them, so he took the whole batch.
I wonder how much money that would be. A bushel, that's a lot of money for morels.
He said he waited very patiently for the next year, hoping that she would call again. But she said when she came in for an appointment, she said, "No, I don't have any of those this year."
That's beautiful. Well, I am not a mycologist or a mushroom expert, but I will say morels are delicious. If you've never had them, try them because they're just absolutely buttery. But also, if you are mushroom hunting, just please make sure you know which mushrooms you're picking and that they're certainly edible, and because there are a lot of mushrooms out there that are not edible and can cause you some harm.
I got a nice bag full from some friends for my birthday. My birthday's May 14th, so I'm right in the season, and they're great at providing me with a gift
pretty
much
wonderful.
Every year. I look forward to seeing them for sure.
And I look forward to you sharing those with me, Larry.
I didn't share them with very far.
I don't blame you. They're valuable.
Oh, man. Jacob and Madison, we'll go to you. Hi, Jacob.
Hi. I was wondering why you wanted reports of foxes and coyotes in the city, because Madison is absolutely infested with rabbits and squirrels. And I think we could use more foxes and squirrels, foxes to get the squirrels and rabbits.
Yes, that is true. That and it's not just foxes rabbits and squirrels, but typically in urban areas, the density or the number of individuals of a particular species of wildlife within a defined area, typically the density of wildlife in urban areas is higher than the density of similar species of wildlife in non-urban areas, just simply because there's so many more resources here, food, space, water, accessibility, things like that. And so even in areas where you do have a lot of rabbits and squirrels, you still may have coyotes and fox around, but you may not have they may not be able to have a top-down regulatory approach or regulation of those prey species, because the prey species are so abundant and they reproduce so quickly that they can compensate for any mortality that is being presented to them via predation, be it hawks, owls, fox, coyotes, raccoons, whatever the case is. So, yeah, but typically we do see sometimes if fox families are in areas, in those local areas, that they will actually reduce the rabbit population or reduce the squirrel population, but they may move, the fox family may move on to another location. And at that point, then that predation is relaxed, and those prey species like squirrels and rabbits are able to recover.
Yeah, there you go, Jacob. Thank you for calling. Diane in Darlington will go to you now. Hi, Diane.
Hi. I love to feed the birds, and it took me several years to get Baltimore Orioles to come to my oranges, and I love feeding them. And it seems like, I think that when their babies fledge, they don't bring them into the oranges and to the jelly, and they're just gone. And I wonder where the heck do they go, because I never see them flying around.
Yeah, well, for most species of birds, and obviously the orioles, but it could be rose-breasted grosbeaks that also will come to your feeder for the oranges, or some people will put jelly out. For those species, as with most other species of birds, is when those young hatch out, they switch over to almost a 100% insect diet. And so they'll bring the insects to the young, and they do that for a number of reasons, obviously because there's an abundance of insects in the springtime, but also those insects are full of protein, and that protein allows the young to grow quickly so that they are of sufficient size so that they either have the ability to migrate in the fall to a southern location where it's warmer, or for the bird species that stay here year-round, that they've got enough body mass on them that they can endure the winter weather. And so that's one of the reasons you're not seeing them at your feeder, the young, because they're eating primarily insects. If you wanted to try to put out some mealworms on a platform feeder or something like that, you may have some luck attracting some of the younger species or other species of birds to your feeder. The other issue is right now we've had a relatively warm and early spring, and so there's an abundance of food in terms of berries and other fruits that are out there right now. And so birds may not be as reliant on feeding stations that people are putting out in their yards as they might be in other years where we've had a late cold spring and that growing season just hasn't really kicked in yet. But this year, because we had such a warm early spring, that the growing season really got an early start, and there's a pretty decent amount of food in the landscape right now. So birds are not as reliant on those feeding stations.
Yeah, Diane, there you go. Thank you. Gene and Merrill will go to you. Hi, Gene.
Hi. When my horse died and we buried her in her pasture, which I rent, the burial site was about 6x10, I think, when we slipped her into the ground. And within a month, there was a rather large but clearly animal dug hole right at the entry point where her head would be. And I thought, well, that's peculiar, and had all sorts of ideas about that. And then over the past, and that was, 7 years ago, over the past few years, a few other holes have sprung up on the periphery, kind of in range of the burial site. It's an 8-acre pasture, and it is grouped right around where the site of the burial is. Well, this spring, I've got 3 new ones that are just concentric from the older ones, and I'm thinking, what the heck's going on? So I talked to the property owner. His best guess was it would be fox or badger or skunk even were digging that.
Yeah, what do you think?
When you first buried the horse and you have, disturbed
soft
soil
ground.
Like that, soft ground, there's a lot of animals that will come to that soft ground, first off, because it's something different in the pasture, and they're investigating it. But also that soft ground is easy to dig through. So. They may smell the horse in there, and especially if you're a scavenging animal or an animal that can scavenge, that's a pretty easy meal for one thing. Recently what I would suggest is it could be badger, it could be fox. The other one I would suggest is groundhog, also called woodchuck. So, and we can talk a little bit more about that after the break if you want to.
Our guest today, David Drake, Extension Wildlife Specialist and Professor. Be with us till 12:30 here on Wisconsin Public Radio News. I'm Larry Mueller. Taking a look at the world of wildlife on the show today, Larry Mueller here with my guest, David Drake, Extension Wildlife Specialist, professor in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison. Questions for him or maybe a wildlife experience to share, the number to call, 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Tom in Peshtigo, what's on your mind?
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've got a camp up in the UP, and there's a lot of logging trails back there, a lot of dirt road logging trails. We go for walks and stuff back there. And on in the side of the road, you'll see holes, maybe 3-4 inches round, and they go back I don't know how far. But I always wondered, does something live in there, or did something go digging for something to eat in there? Is there anything in those holes, and what makes them?
Yeah, that's a good question, Tom. I think, you know, 3 or 4 inches wide in diameter is a pretty good size hole. I was thinking, you know, maybe a chipmunk or a 13-line ground squirrel or something like that, but maybe that's about a 2-inch in diameter hole. You know, 3 or 4 inches is I'm trying to think about an animal that would make a hole that size, because it's kind of a weird size for a hole. Not to say that that hole may not have gotten enlarged by something, and certainly there are weasel species that will go down those holes to chase after their food source, be it chipmunks, 13-line ground squirrels, whatever. So maybe the hole got enlarged a little bit. It certainly could have gotten dug out. You know, rabbits, skunks, other things like that will dig those holes out and use them as dens or little den burrows. So that could have happened. So it's impossible to, I guess, based on the description, Tom, I'm at a loss for what it could be definitively. But a couple of suggestions is, if you have the ability to put a wildlife camera over that hole, you might be able to see what's coming and going if it is being actively used. The other thing is, if it's on the side of a dirt road and that soil is relatively fine, you might be able to just rake that soil out and see if you can catch a track in the substrate and see if you can figure out what the animal is based on that. And you're welcome, if you do get a track, you're welcome to send it to me with a picture if you want to do that. I would just encourage you to put down a set of keys or a pocket knife or a ruler or something like that for scale, which would perhaps help to identify the track. But you may also want to look and see if it's an active hole. Typically, you'll see fresh dirt that might have been scratched out of it. You might see tracks. Depending on the species, you might see scat at the hole entrance, or perhaps body parts of what the animal might be eating. Things like that.
And our executive producer and also wildlife expert, Jill Nadeau, says she thinks, and she's from kind of up that area, she says it's chippies.
Yeah, it could be. It could be. You know, typically 3 to 4 inches in diameter is a little bit big for a chipmunk burrow. But
I think he may be a little on the size.
Yeah, but I think that's what I would assume, too, is chipmunks or 13-line ground squirrels, something like that.
Tom, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Email to talk@wpr.org. You recently returned from a summer field experience at the Kemp Research Facility.
Yes, it was wonderful. So every other year, our department offers a summer wildlife field course. It's a 2-week-long experience. It's held at Kemp Natural Resource Station, which is one of the ag research stations that the University of Wisconsin system owns. It's up on the beautiful shores of Lake Tomahawk, just outside Minocqua. And so this year, we had Wildlife Summer Field Course, and Scott Craven is involved in it. He's was the one who started it. I think the first course was in 1999. So Craven, even though he's retired, he comes up and he cooks for the two weeks.
He's the camp cook.
He's the camp cook, yep. And if you've ever had anything Scott's cooked, he's a very good cook. So we don't go hungry. Jamie Knack, who is usually on the program with me, with you, Larry, and she's up there, and so it was really fun. We had 22 wildlife undergraduate students from our program, and so for 2 weeks they're housed up there at Kemp Natural Resource Station. They're broken into 4 groups. Each group is provided a group leader, and so I'm one of the group leaders or one of the instructors, and then typically Jamie is, and we've got a couple of this year we had a couple of PhD students on the wildlife side of our department who served as group leaders as well. And each group is assigned a tract of land on the Kemp property, so anywhere from 40 to 60 acres, something like that. And they are responsible for inventorying and monitoring wildlife. So we teach them all sorts of different ways to monitor bird species and reptiles and amphibians and small mammals, medium and large mammals, things like that. They're also responsible for identifying and assessing the vegetation types, plant communities that are on their site. And by the end of the two-week period, they're supposed to write, and they do write. They do a very good job, typically. They write a management plan for how they would suggest to manage that property. They come up with scenarios, and then they will write a management plan based on the scenarios, based on we want to increase biodiversity on the property, or we want to increase game species, or we want to, perhaps log the property, harvest timber off the property for monetary gain, or whatever the case is. And they write a management plan, and then they present the management plan in an oral presentation as a group presentation at the end of the 2 weeks. And so we just concluded our summer camp last Friday, May 31st, and we had a great, great time. We had generally good weather, some rain, but we were able to work around that. And we can report the ticks and mosquitoes are out in force. So one of my students in my group, he kept track, and he said he had 63 ticks on him by the end of the 2 weeks.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
Do they do this for credit, or do they?
Yeah, they do it for credit. Yep. It's optional, so it's not required that they take summer camp, but it's a two-credit course, and so they pay tuition dollars for it, and they go up. But we teach them skills that they can put on their resume, and then that helps them be competitive for summer seasonal field work and graduate school and all sorts of things like that. It really, a lot of times for most of these students, it's their first opportunity to get out in the field and have an experience like this, especially as we talked about, most kids are from urban areas these days.
Yeah.
And so it really gives them an opportunity to understand if they're in the right major or not. Because if you don't like this experience, after 2 weeks, then you probably are not in the right major, and which is important to know. And then, these kids get pretty close with each other, not only within their own group, but across the other groups. And so it really builds a very strong cohort of students that they can travel through the remaining years in college in our major. And that they form really, tight bonds, friendships, networks, and things like that.
I think it's an absolutely wonderful program, yeah, for sure.
It is. And I'll tell you what, all of us as instructors, we went into this field because we want to be outdoors and doing this kind of stuff. And obviously, we're stuck behind desks most of the time. So for us, it's a real joy also because we get to be outside every day for 2 weeks.
Hmm. Well, on to some other things. Paul in Cross Plains has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Paul.
Hello. How are you, Larry?
Great. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
First of all, thanks for taking my call. I live in the country, and this has been something I think I haven't heard on your program, the answer to this question. But the deer and the moose and the elk, they're all ungulates, and so are cows. And I'm just wondering whether there is some barrier to keep chronic wasting disease away from the cattle population in Wisconsin, because that would really be catastrophic.
Yeah, it would.
Yeah, Paul, that's a good question. I am not a wildlife disease expert, but I will give you my knowledge on this. And so yes, you're absolutely right. The wild ungulates would be deer, moose, elk, and all those species, but in particular deer and elk, are susceptible to chronic wasting disease. In terms of domestic cattle, so cows, typically that shows up as bovine spongiform encephalopathy, or BSE. Mad cow disease is sometimes what it's referred to. And so these prion diseases, that they can be somewhat species specific. So it's called chronic wasting disease in these wild ungulates, BSE in domestic cattle. It's scrappy in sheep, for example. And so it's all, as I understand it, all in the same family of disease, but it's called a different disease or shows up in a different variation depending on the animal that it evolves in.
And fortunately, the mad cow disease is I mean, we it occurs
yes.
in Wisconsin, but it's not nearly as prevalent as I don't think as it is in the wild.
Yeah, I don't recall that. I don't know that we've had a case of mad cow in Wisconsin. We may have. I just may not be yeah. aware of it. And if we have, it's not very prevalent. But you know, what was it back in the 80s or 90s when it hit the UK? I mean, they depopulated, you know, farms widely anywhere that BSE was found, that mad cow disease was found. And it is, you know, I know we're getting off topic here, but our United States Department of Agriculture does a phenomenal job of monitoring these types of diseases. Because if it ever does get into the livestock population, you know, and it doesn't matter what the disease is, but it can be absolutely devastating from a monetary standpoint.
Paul, good question. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. You can join in to 800-642-1234, email to talk@wpr.org. You know, we were talking about your summer field experience, which is a great couple-week thing. There's another experience I wanted to mention, and that's the Culverts Project.
Yeah, the Culverts Project is coming up in August. I wish Jamie was here because she's the organizer of that program, but I'm not sure if you can still apply for it. But the Culverts Project is a project that is supported by the Ruffed Grouse Society and others, but essentially it is for private forest landowners, primarily in Wisconsin, but we've had landowners from Minnesota, Michigan, Illinois, other places like that, part of this. And in August, we go up to Kemp Natural Resources Station, which we just talked about, with upwards of 25 to 30 Culverts cooperators or private forest landowners. And they're sequestered at Kemp. They come in on a Thursday afternoon, Thursday around mid-afternoon. They leave Sunday afternoon. And that entire time between Thursday afternoon and Sunday afternoon, we have in-class instruction where we've got a number of instructors, including Scott, Jamie, and myself, as well as people from the DNR and the U.S. Forest Service and others, Rough Grouse Society. So we give them in-class instruction. Then we take them out on field trips and we show them different harvesting techniques. We show them different ways to monitor wildlife on their property, similar to what we just talked about with our wildlife students. And things like that. But it's an opportunity for a program to show forest landowners how to manage their forest land for wildlife, and in particular, a lot of young forest succession for things like rough grouse. We focus on rough grouse and woodcock, but we also talk about a wide range of things from turkeys to deer to non-game species and things of that nature. The program is free. So there's a cost, but the cost is subsidized by cooperators and funders of the Culverts program. So thanks to all of them. And if you're interested in this, I would just suggest you go into your search engine on the internet, and it's Culverts. So C as in Charlie, C-O-V as in Victor, E-R-T-S, program, Wisconsin, and it'll pop right up. You may still be able to apply. I think Jamie, I can't remember if she's still processing applications or not. But the application date will be clearly identified on the website. And if you missed the application for this year, we have a Culverts program every year. So look for the application for next year, and please do apply because it is an absolutely wonderful program. And I wish, again, Jamie was here. I can't remember the number of cooperators, but it's over 500, I believe. And the number of acres that we've impacted directly or indirectly is well over, I think, 10,000 acres and more probably.
Yeah. Randy in Hayward has something for us. Let's go there. Randy, hello. Thank you for calling.
Hello, Larry. Larry, thanks for taking my call. So I usually hear at meetings that are held in various places in the state that the wolves are killing all the deer. I thought that I had heard or read at one time that a deer, or I should say a wolf, even if deer is their entire diet, would only probably take 20 deer per year. So a rough estimate, maybe we have 1,000 wolves in the state. That would translate into 20,000 deer, which in the scheme of things is not many, knowing that our deer population is millions. I just wondered if your guest could speak to that.
Sure.
Yeah, I'd be glad to. And you just dropped a hand grenade right into the middle of the conversation because wolves and deer is a hot button topic or issue for sure, especially up north. So, yes, wolves a lot of times are implicated in what is perceived as a low deer population. And so you're absolutely right that given the number of wolves that we have in the state of Wisconsin currently and in the past, they do not have a tremendous impact on the overall deer population. Now, certainly if a wolf pack is in the area, they will impact locally, in that local area, they will impact the deer population, either by predation or by moving the deer population out. So if you're a deer and your predators are living close by, a good life strategy is not to be near the predators, and so you might move out. So in a localized area, and again, what typically you hear this from is primarily from deer hunters, not necessarily from people who are not deer hunters. But if you're a deer hunter and there's a wolf pack nearby, it is possible you're not going to see as many deer as perhaps if the wolf pack is not there. But you are correct that over the grand scheme of things and keeping things in perspective, the wolves in the state of Wisconsin have a minimal impact on the number of deer that are harvested or predated, I should say, especially if you look at the number of deer that are harvested by humans, the number of deer that are killed by vehicles, by cars and things like that. The wolves, it's a relatively minimal number of deer that are taken by wolves.
Yeah, I was thinking about where I hunt in Bayfield County. Mm-hmm. There's a pack that's there, but they have about a 5 square mile yeah. area of coverage. And so some years they'll be in our area and all right, we're not going to see as many
yeah.
deer.
Yeah.
But then they're in a different area a couple miles away yep. or 3 miles away, and then the deer are back.
Yeah, yep, that's right. That's exactly right. So, and deer are in those, I mean, northern Wisconsin, the forested area of Wisconsin, it is pretty saturated with wolves right now for the most part. Yeah. But, you know, but deer still, they do live up there, and they're reproducing and compensating for that mortality.
Yeah, absolutely. Randy, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. And you can join in too, 800-642-1234, email to talk@wpr.org. I want to go back to that Culverts project for just a minute because there's one thing that you didn't mention, I don't think, and that is the participants then turn around yeah. and become speakers yeah. or proponents themselves.
Yep, yep. So, you know, one of the things with land ownership, and in particular forest land ownership, is you have a lot of absentee landowners. So people who own forest land, but they may not necessarily live on that land that they own. And so they may not visit it as frequently as or manage it as actively as perhaps if you live there on that land. And so one of the things with the Culverts project is to try to, you know, incentivize or to try to create some activities so that there's greater management of the forest land and it's not just taking place as it is. And so one of the requirements of the Culverts project is that, yes, you please come here for free and we'll educate you. But then when you go back home, we would like you to go and talk to your neighbors, talk to your friends, family, other landowners, and to do some kind of an outreach or dissemination of what you've learned and share that information with other people to try to spread the word, spread the education, but also to try to encourage others to take active management of their property as well. So be it removal of invasive species or new tree plantings or whatever the case might be. And we encourage people to create outreach and dissemination in all sorts of different ways. You know, it could just be simply talking to your neighbor over the fence. It could be having some kind of a landowner event on your property where you invite people to your property and have a demonstration area where you can talk about what you're doing on your property. It might be writing a piece in the local newspaper or in the Woodland Owners magazine or whatever the case might be. But yes, you're absolutely right. And the dissemination and the trainer, so to speak, that model has been very, very successful and very impactful through the Culverts program.
John in West Salem wonders about the frog and toad surveys.
Yeah. Yeah. So I believe they're still going on right now. But if you are interested, go to your search engine on your internet and just type in Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources Frog and Toad Survey. It's the longest running citizen science project in the state of Wisconsin. And Essentially, if you're not already a part of that, you can be. You would go out to a wetland. There's a strict protocol that you'll follow you'll, by listening, and then it's essentially an index count. So you'll say one, two, or three. So you give that area one if you're hearing individual frogs or toads calling. And each frog species and the one toad species we have in the state of Wisconsin, they all have species-specific calls, very similar to a bird call. So, you know, if a robin is calling, you know what that robin sounds like. Or if a black and white warblers calling, you know what that sounds like. Very similar. If a wood frog's calling, that wood frog has a call very specific to that species and different than a green frog would call. So you listen to that. If you hear an individual here and there, you give that area a one. If you hear multiple individuals, but you can still make out the individuals, you give that area a two in terms of index count. And if you hear just this symphony of frog and toads and you can't make out individuals, you give that index count of three. And so it's an awesome experience, a great way to get your kids and family involved, wonderful way to get out and view, and experience some incredible wetland and aquatic areas in the state of Wisconsin.
Phil in Oshkosh, what's on your mind?
Hello. At UWO, they have a high-rise dorm with a peregrine nesting box on top of it for years. And this year, they've just talked about having five chicks that they just banded. And I'm curious, where do all these chicks disperse to? I only see them around the high-rise dorm, but I only ever see a pair usually. Where do they go?
Yeah, so they'll go find some new territory, possibly. Not all the chicks survive, so some will die of predation. Some might die of disease, whatever the other causes of mortality might be. And so they'll spread out. But a lot of times you'll find them around cities because those cities, those high-rise buildings, kind of replicate what these birds use in the wild, and that would be cliff faces and rocky structures where they can have kind of a elevated perch that they can take off from to start that dive or that very speedy dive that they go into. But they also a lot of times will nest on edges of the cliff because that nest then on the edge of the cliff is protected somewhat from predators. And so these high-rise buildings and cities kind of replicate what they find out in these more natural areas of their habitat. And so, and peregrine falcons, it is the recovery of the peregrine falcons has been a success story in the United States in terms of wildlife management. And it is an awesome story if you're not familiar with it. Google peregrine falcons and read about DDT and the recovery of the peregrine falcon.
And they disperse, those young.
They will, disperse, yep.
Yep, they take off. Well, on that note, David, thank you so much. Appreciate it very much. We'll look forward to your next visit.
Thank you so much, Larry. Have a good rest of your day.
David Drake, Extension Wildlife Specialist, professor in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology, our guest. He'll be back on August 7th with Jamie. Stay with us. We'll be taking a closer look at turtles when we come back. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining us today on Wisconsin Public Radio News. Larry Mueller here. We're going to talk turtles. Now, there are 11 kinds of turtles, types of turtles here in the state, and we're going to take a closer look at them with our guest. Back with us once again, Carly Lape, and she is the North Central Regional Ecologist with the Wisconsin DNR. Great to have Carly with us today. And as we talk about turtles, I hope you'll join in. If you got an experience to share, give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Carly Lapin, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Hi, Larry. Thanks. Glad to be here.
So we've got 11 species of turtles, or what are the turtle species in Wisconsin and how are they categorized?
Oh, that's correct. Yeah, we have 11 species throughout the state. Some are locally in some areas of the state, but not others. Some specify in different types of water bodies, like rivers or large rivers or lakes. Some of our most common that people are probably familiar with are snapping turtles and painted turtles. Some of our larger river turtles include the soft shells. We have two species, both smooth and spiny. We also have three species of map turtle that are associated almost exclusively with the big rivers in the west and south part of Wisconsin. And then we have a couple listed species as well. So those include the wood turtle, which is state listed as a threatened species and currently being considered for federal listing by the Fish and Wildlife Service. And also the ornate box turtle, which is state endangered. A couple others that I haven't mentioned yet are the Blandings turtle, which is also currently being considered by the Fish and Wildlife Service for federal listing, and the eastern musk turtle, which is found in the southeast part of the state.
So lots of turtles, or at least species, lots of species here.
Yeah.
You mentioned the ornate and the wood turtles, and both of those, well, wait a minute. The ornate, I believe, is terrestrial totally.
That's correct.
And the wood turtle is mostly terrestrial?
You're right. The ornate box turtle is exclusively terrestrial. They're found in dry sand prairies and oak savannas and don't really go near water bodies at all. So a little bit different from what most people think of when they think of turtles. Wood turtles are, we call, semi-aquatic. So they do spend a good portion of the year in a river or a stream, especially the winter. They spend the winter underwater. But then during the warm summer months, they can be on land for almost the entire summer, especially the female wood turtles, which tend to range even pretty far from their home water bodies.
Yeah. We have a few non-natives too, don't we?
I think we have, we can sometimes find red-eared sliders in Wisconsin, which are pets that have been released. And then eastern box turtles are native to North America, but we don't have any native populations in Wisconsin. So those could be released pets as well, or relocated individuals from elsewhere.
Yeah, that's kind of too bad in a way, because I know the red sliders can take over an area, if I'm not mistaken.
I think they can be problematic for some of our native turtle species.
So you mentioned at least three that are turtle species that are endangered or getting close to that endangered status. What are the threats?
Well, I would say turtles in general, all turtles are somewhat at risk because they are a species that they live a long time and they reproduce later in life, and very few of their offspring survive. So in general, turtles can be at risk from due to various threats that might affect their populations, and things can affect their populations pretty quickly. Some of our more rare species in the state are primarily threatened by habitat loss. And then also a big threat for some of our rare turtle species is poaching. So illegal collection for the pet trade is a big problem throughout North America and can really devastate local populations if that is occurring.
Yeah, that's really too bad. Thinking about our ecosystem and the role of turtles, what part do turtles play in our ecosystem?
Turtles are a part of the food chain. So they eat various organisms and sometimes eat carrion and help digest those types of things. I believe, provide value in and of themselves as part of the greater ecosystem and the web of life. They do have some cultural significance for different groups throughout the state as well and throughout history. So they're long-lived creatures, and they've seen a lot of things in general.
Yeah. How long? I imagine, is it the snapper that's the longest live of our Wisconsin turtles?
Our snapping turtles get the largest of our turtle species in the state, but I don't know specifically what the longest lifespan of a snapping turtle can be expected to be. I am more familiar with wood turtles, and we do know or have documented individuals that are in their 60s, and that's from marking and recapturing them, you know, over time. And they can probably get to be older than that. So we don't really know just how old they can be.
But that's 60 years. My goodness.
Yeah, a long time.
That is indeed a long time. I know we have protections, or we try to protect. I have a good friend of mine was trying to protect some eggs recently by actually putting some kind of fence around an egg nest. He saw the turtle laying the eggs, and so he protected that. And then apparently some other turtles came in and into that same area nearby, and he didn't notice that until he discovered that something had been digging up the eggs and eating the eggs.
Sure, yeah, that can happen. So nest predation is fairly common. There's, you know, eggs are a really valuable food source for a lot of animals. They provide a lot of protein and calories. And so if any animal sees or finds a wood turtle or any type of turtle laying eggs, they will take advantage of that opportunity for sure. DNR does have some resources on its website about creating a nest cage. So it's a pretty simple structure made out of hardware cloth that you can put over a turtle nest and then stake it down with tent stakes to try and prevent, you know, that predation from happening. Some of the most common predators of turtle eggs are skunks and raccoons, but we see birds, chipmunks, squirrels, foxes, coyotes, yeah, bears, you know, anything really. That's a good source of food and protein for them.
Linda in Green Bay, we'll go to you. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind? Linda, are you there?
Oh, yes, I'm here.
Yeah, go ahead. What's your question?
Hi there. I'm sorry. I didn't know I was live. I have a pond that's a little probably over quarter of an acre, maybe a little bigger. And for years, we've been trying to rescue painted turtles and get them in that pond. But we think that there's a snapping turtle in there because we haven't seen any of those painted turtles. And I'm just wondering if that snapper is maybe eating them, you know.
Yeah. So will a snapper eat a painted turtle?
I would assume so if this painted turtle is small enough that could happen. Yeah.
So you might have one in there, Linda. You might have one there.
Okay, the next question is, how do I get it out of there?
Well, I guess it depends on your perspective, but I think mine would be that snapping turtles provide a lot of benefit as well. And, you know, I don't think there's anything wrong with them. They eat a lot of other creatures that you might not want there as well. So I'm not sure.
Okay, there you go, Linda. Ken in Wild Rose will give you a chance. Hi, Ken.
I have we're up on a lake near Wild Rose, and recently we saw a musk turtle up there. It definitely was a musk turtle, but I noticed you said that they're in southeastern Wisconsin. I was just wondering if that's a definitive or...
Well, I have to check the range map for musk turtles. Let me take a look here. I've only seen a handful of these ever, and they were in far southeastern Wisconsin, but I do see they do go up into the Oshkosh, Appleton, Wild Rose area. So you're in the range there.
Yeah. What is, how would you describe a musk turtle in terms, you know, looking at turtles? How would I know that's a musk turtle?
Well, so musk turtles don't tend to come out of the water very much, so you probably won't see them often unless you happen to be in the water and find one there. They're pretty small. They're one of the smallest turtles in the world, and they have kind of a pointed snout and a round domed carapace or upper shell. They do kind of emit like a smell if you capture one. So they're also known as the stink pot or, you know, musk turtle. And like I said, they spend most of their time in the water, in lakes and river backwaters, often where there's good vegetation. They eat snails, clams, and aquatic insects. So probably not frequently encountered, but they are very interesting.
Yeah, and do they come out of the water to lay their eggs in? I assume so.
Yes, the females will come out of the water to lay their eggs, and sometimes they'll come out to get warm so that their eggs develop more quickly. But for the most part, they are in the water.
All right. Ken, thank you very much for calling. You were lucky you saw to see a musk turtle, for sure. You can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. Our guest today, Carly Lapin, a North Central Regional Ecologist with the Wisconsin DNR. We're talking turtles. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking turtles on the program now. Larry Mueller here with our guest, Carly Lapin, North Central Regional Ecologist with the Wisconsin DNR. You can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or you can email us to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Love to hear from you. Is the DNR, or should I put it this way, what is being done, if anything, by the DNR to try and help protect turtles?
Well, we do have a couple of different conservation projects ongoing. Those are mostly focused on habitat. So restoring habitat for ornate box turtles is one. And we also do some work to restore or create nesting habitat for turtles, primarily focusing on wood turtles, but all turtles use the sites that we work on. And the reason being is that nesting habitat, which is sand or gravel that's exposed near rivers or streams or lakes, is kind of in short supply because of, we have a lot of water control structures on our rivers now where historically they would have flooded and created open sandy areas, but that doesn't happen anymore because of water control structures. And also there would have been a lot of fire on the landscape in the past, and that's not happening anymore. So things kind of get overgrown, and then that nesting habitat's not available. So that's why we see turtles nesting on the shoulders of roads and gravel roads and driveways and construction projects and things like that. So we're trying to make that nesting habitat more available to them so they're not running into those dangerous situations quite as frequently. So those are a couple examples.
Penny in Winona, Minnesota, we go to you now. Hi, Penny.
Hi, good afternoon. So when I was a child, my father on Long Island in New York, my father, if he found turtles in the road, he'd worry about them getting hit. So we eventually had like 30 turtles living in our backyard in a, you know, confined area, quite large with a pond. And eventually, after about 15 years, he found a turtle sanctuary in Pennsylvania and relocated them. Now, I've always heard since then that a turtle will always try to get back to where it is like its home base. So I always worry, looking back on that, oh my gosh, did all those turtles not stay put where they were? Or will they, if they've got a nice habitat, will they make themselves at home?
Yeah, that's a good question, Penny. I think that, you know, probably it sounds like those turtles were well cared for, and, you know, turtles can do well in captivity, but for sure, any of our wild turtles, we want to keep wild. And they do try and get back to their home range. They're really creatures of habit. So they are very connected to their little area that they live in. And there's examples of turtles being washed away by flooding and then being able to find their way back if they don't get washed too far away to where they had always lived. So they're very tied to their place. They do best kind of out in the wild, and And if you do see turtles crossing the road, it's typically because they're trying to find a good spot to lay eggs. One way you can help protect them is if it's safe to do so, you can pull over and help them get across the road. And we always advise that you move them in the direction that they're heading, because that's where they're trying to get to and they're persistent. But yeah, like some of the best things we can do are just make sure we're not accidentally hitting them and then giving them a chance by helping them cross the road in a safe manner if the opportunity arises.
Penny, thank you so much. It's a great story. Appreciate it. Rick in Colfax, your turn. Hi, Rick.
Hello. Thank you. Great show, Larry. Okay, so I have a small pond on my property, a drainage pond that's got 4 or 5 feet of water in it this time of year. And I've had turtles in there for the duration, which is 20 years, but over the past 15 years, some blanding turtles.
You have some blanding turtles enter your pond, did you say?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. There's some blanding turtles in there. I find their sheds.
Oh, you're breaking up, unfortunately, Rick. And I didn't hear that last part. Maybe try that last part once more.
Okay, I'm sorry. I try to get to a little better spot here. Is it okay now?
Yeah, you're fine.
Okay, so my question is there, could I put something to feed the turtles in there, such as minnows or something like that, you know, just to help them along through the year? And is there anything I should do considering there's a couple blanding turtles in there?
Yeah. Okay.
So, Rick, have you noticed that there are fewer turtles than there used to be, or have they persisted over time?
They've persisted over time. As a matter of fact, normally there's around a half a dozen that I see come up on the logs. I throw logs over the winter. This year was a record year. I counted 12. Normally there's only 5 or 6.
Okay.
Oh, that's really cool. Yeah, I think from what it sounds like they're doing really well in your pond. So I don't see any reason why you would need to supplement food or anything like that. It seems like they're pretty happy. And if you do have Blanding's turtles, then I think you could consider yourself lucky. You know, one thing you might consider is providing some nesting habitat and in the form of like some nice sandy areas for them to lay eggs and keeping those areas free from vegetation. And if that's something that you were interested in, you could contact me at DNR to give you some guidance on that, if that's something you would consider.
Rick, there you go. Thank you so much. And Carly Liepen is our guest today. And I guess if you went to the DNR North Central Regional, there's a website for your region, is there not, Carly?
Yes, yes. I work with the Bureau of Natural Heritage Conservation. We used to be the Bureau of Endangered Resources.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. There you go. Thank you so much. Pam in Tomahawk, your turn. Hi, Pam.
Hello. My husband and I built a pond about 4 or 5 years ago. It's a small pond, about 36 feet by 18 or so. And it's 7 feet deep at its deepest. And we put in a cedar log that's about 5-6 inches wide and about 5 feet deep, or 5 feet long, and it's anchored by a couple bricks. And it's really, it attracts so many mud turtles that we kind of have got a relationship with the turtles because we watch who's on there and the size of them and everything. So if you do have a pond and a log is a really good place for them to sun. Right now we've got 3 on the log.
Oh.
I'm looking at them right now. So it was just a suggestion, if you do have a pond, then you really get to see the turtles, and they're pretty safe out there. I know when we go outside or go near the pond, they all jump off into the water, but you can see their heads popping up. But yeah, they've become a real asset to our summers.
Oh, that sounds wonderful. Comment, Carly?
Oh, I think that's a great recommendation. Something to note that, yeah, they do really appreciate having that basking habitat, whether it's boulders or logs. It's a good way to see some of the turtles that use those specifically.
Yeah, thank you, Pam. Appreciate that very much. And thanks for what you're doing for the turtles. Let's go to Dan in Lake Mills next. Hi, Dan.
Yeah, hi. How's it going?
Great. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Yeah, so I live in Lake Mills on the north end of Rock Lake there, beautiful body of water. And we have a county highway in between our house and the lake. And just over the last couple of days, it happens every year, but I've seen more than a dozen, large, spiny, soft-shell turtles that come up to the edge of the road to lay their eggs and nest. And obviously it creates kind of a dangerous situation with all the cars going by. But also a lot of people stop and try and help the turtles all across the road. So I try and spend my mornings babysitting these turtles to make sure people aren't helping them cross the road, because once they lay their eggs, they turn around and go right back to the lake. Just wondering if there's any suggestions for, protecting those turtles and, protecting the nests afterwards, because raccoons will come up and like to dig up the eggs and eat them.
Hmm.
Yeah, those are some good questions, Dan, and thank you for watching out for their soft shells there. You're correct. The soft shells typically stay very close to the water. When I've seen them, they're always nesting right at the water's edge, and they don't go very far from the water ever. So they like to be able to get back into it quickly. Mm-hmm. We do have some situations where local municipalities or counties have put up turtle crossing signs on the road just to warn people to watch out for them. But you're right. It doesn't sound like a situation where they're trying to cross the road. So we don't necessarily want that to happen, because they'll just go right back. So I'm not really sure how you might educate local folks as to what the turtles are doing or trying to do in that situation. It sounds like a tough one. Once they have nested, you could look into using some nest cages to protect them from predation. DNR does have some links on our website for how to make those, some designs that you might use. However, if it's on the shoulder of a county highway, those, they may not be functional just because of mowing practices and things like that. So this might be a situation where you need to talk to your county board and see if there's anything that you can do and work with them on it.
Yeah, there you go, Dan. Thank you so much for calling. Carly, maybe you could tell us about the Wisconsin Turtle Conservation Program.
Sure. So the Wisconsin Turtle Conservation Program is run by Wisconsin DNR, and just trying to get the word out on how people can help turtles in their local area. We do have a place where people can report turtle crossing locations. So we've begun tracking that. And if we're finding hot spots where we're having high numbers of turtles crossing roads or being victim of road mortality, then we can try and address those situations on a case-by-case basis if we have the opportunity to do so.
Very, very cool. All this talk about eggs reminded me of my daughter's recent experience. She was in Grenada and doing some diving on reefs for a research project. And while she was there, another researcher who was researching leatherbacks invited her along on an evening foray, and he asked her, a 6-foot leatherback came up on the beach and was laying its eggs, and she got to, he said, catch the eggs as they come out and test for viability. And so she said she held about 140 eggs in her, 130 eggs in her hand, and about 20 of them were not viable, the rest were, but she had to hold the turtle's fin back while she was doing it a little bit, and it was a wonderful experience for her.
Yeah, what an incredible experience. They're remarkable animals. They get to be so big, and yeah, just very interesting.
Carly, great. Thank you so much for being with us today. I appreciate it. We'll look forward to your next visit.
Thank you, Larry.
Carly Lapin of the Wisconsin DNR. Thank you for listening, and stay with us. Lots in store on Wisconsin Public Radio News. I'm Larry Mueller.